Hey there, I'm Josh Tyson, co-author of Age of Invisible Machines, the first best-selling book about conversational AI. Age of Invisible Machines explores the learnings of conversational AI veteran and OneReach.ai CEO Rob Wilson. Each week, Rob and I bring in a guest to continue the conversations we started in the pages of our book. This week on the Invisible Machines podcast, we're talking about the critical difference between design and documentation, why high-level design thinking is more important now than ever, and how micro UIs will fundamentally alter our interactions with technology. Our guest this week is author and UX legend Greg Noodleman. Greg honed his craft as a design lead at GE Digital, Cisco, and eBay, and has worked with organizations like IBM, Oracle, Associated Press, and Intuit. Greg is currently a distinguished designer at Sumo and has written numerous books, including The $1 Prototype and Designing Search. He joins us for a compelling conversation that explores the ways we can improve experience design, iterating faster and further in the age of conversational AI. And as you'll hear me mention in a moment, Greg was actually one of the original guests on the In Conversation with UX Magazine podcast over 8 years ago. We were delighted to have him back and are happy to share with you now this illuminating chat with Greg Noodleman. Invisible Machines is produced in partnership with OneReach.ai. Their Generative Studio X platform is the only orchestration platform that's been named a leader by every major analyst group. Enterprises and other organizations are already using GSX to create technology ecosystems where they can grow their own digital teammates, called intelligent digital workers. These IDWs can be set to work with hundreds of customizable skills utilizing GSX's no-code building tools. Head to OneReach.ai to test drive an IDW and experience the next phase of generative AI. Well, Greg, thanks so much for joining us today. We are definitely looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, likewise. I'm excited to come back after, what, it's been a while, right? 10 years, maybe more.
So, crazy.
Yeah. I was just listening to our previous conversation. So Greg was a guest on an episode of In Conversation with UX Magazine from about like 8 years ago.
Man.
You had just, I think, released your book, The $1 Prototype. And we had a conversation about the power of rapid iteration processes with lower stakes. You know, in our book, the book that Rob and I wrote, we talk a lot about how the iterative process for designing experiences with conversational AI needs to move at a much quicker pace than even many designers might be prepared for. We call it more agile than agile. So I was just wondering, like, how do you see conversational AI and perhaps maybe generative AI in particular changing the ways designers are working, both kind of in terms of the process and then also the increasingly conversational experiences that they're endeavoring to design?
I was so glad you asked that, because I think there's so much focus in our industry on sort of deliverables, and we're just overly obsessed about wireframes. And this whole notion that there may not even be a wireframe, and that's sort of an impediment to an experience, and we got to think about it in a completely different fashion and iterate way faster than we are. I totally agree about the speed. I just finished probably second or third, I want to say third, yeah, third workshop on kind of using lean UX, or sort of $1 prototype type of notions for constructing interfaces for AI. And if there's one takeaway, is that we got to think bigger and from kind of the truly user experience perspective, like everything from onboarding to what is it like in a car to what is it like if you're walking around and distracted or whatever, and then also telling the full end-to-end story. But that's really what allows us to iterate really fast and is documenting our assumptions and then getting out there and testing it with customers in situ. And that is something people just aren't getting. They're so fixated still, unfortunately. A lot of folks are completely fixated on, help me make prettier wireframes.
Yes.
More high def stuff. I'm still working on like processing the fact just how much of a lift it's going to have to be for us as an industry to realize that things have changed and it's not about the wireframes anymore.
It's the way I frame it for myself is that in the UX world, we have lived in a geospatial world, right? Where things are right or left of other things or below or above something else. And to get somewhere, you have to go over here. Then you'll see a drop down on the right, like go to the post office, make a right. You'll see, you know, a pink house on the corner. You know, it's the same geospatial idea of go over here, then go over there, then look at the drop down, then find where it says blah. Then you see the button on the right. Yeah, go down to that button. And even our vocabulary is geospatial, like go over here, go over there, see that thing, you know, go to that thing and then to the right, to the left. And we're not really great. Our geospatial capabilities are, you know, far less sophisticated than our linguistic capabilities, you know. I forget, you know, where things are in places I've only been to once. But I can always remember how to ask where's the post office, but I can't remember the directions on how to get there. But I can remember how to ask where it is. And it shows that if we can shift to a linguistic part of our brain and use different areas than the geospatial areas, we can win. But as designers, we design in geospace, right? So like you said, we want to draw things. We want to draw wireframes, like wireframes is a map. Like we want to draw maps, but all of a sudden it's not a city that is on one plane. It's not just a city that's level. We're now talking about a city that can go up or down on multiple layers infinitely, or wide or small infinitely. And you can teleport from one area to the city to another area to the city instantly. And you're like, you can't draw that anymore. It no longer looks like a map, and it looks more like an ontology where it's all about nodes and relationships, and there's 100 different ways now to get to a place. And so the second you grab a pencil and a pen and you try to draw a map of an interface, you have just locked into a single level. There's no underground, above ground. It's just one layer, and you've limited yourself to a city that, you know, that in itself is not going to scale. And so now you go to a conversation where I can say, show me sales for last month. Boom, I teleport straight to that tab, to that, you know, to the drop down that's where I choose the date, to the line chart, you know, like all those selections, just I don't need to navigate to it. Just boom, there it is on the left. The chart pops up. And then I'm like, actually, can you show it by location? I'd like to see just US. Boom, teleport over there. Oh, wait, now I'd like to go share this with someone in an email. You know, I don't even care if it's email, just share this with someone. Boom, teleport to my email client. I don't even have to leave this interface. It packages that up, sends it to the person. Oh, make sure that they acknowledge that they got it. Okay, we'll do. Now that navigation is about teleportation, and then you no longer draw it on a single plane. A piece of paper is a single plane. You can't think in paper. You can't think in drawings. You have to think in ontologies and nodes and connections. It's more like looking at someone's family tree, except where it's not hierarchical, where I can be the parent and child of the same person. That does blow our minds, right? It's like a whole new way of seeing information architecture. And I think it's a huge change and shift for people because all their tools change and how they think changes and their research changes because they're not trying to figure out how obvious it is for somebody to find out sales for last year. The other thing that's amazing is user research. When you're in that geospatial world and someone arrives at a in an application or a website, they won't tell you what they expected or wanted from it. They'll click on something you presented. And by the sheer fact that they click on something you presented, you assume that they've been presented with everything that they wanted. But it's like having a grocery store with 10 things in it, and then seeing that if they bought something, that must have been what they wanted. But in conversation, they can say, hey, I want sales for last month. That not be something that you've designed in. You can capture that, and now your roadmap and your product roadmap is driven by what the user wants and expects from the system. And so you don't longer have to separate research as an upfront waterfall to figure out what users want from an interface, because they're telling you every day. All you have to do is read the information, classify it, do a count, and you got an instant product roadmap based on user research. And that's the part I think I'm most excited about, is this new technology drives us to value research more just by it being like not waterfall. So sorry, you hit on a hot topic for me.
I love everything you said, and I totally agree. One of my favorite examples is at least used to be sort of almost an unachievable level of sophistication, saying, give me directions to a dental office. And I don't remember the name of it, but it's near the theater.
Right.
And I've been there three months ago. Like, there's almost no UI today that's going to make that type of connection. In fact, even thinking through that, it's such an esoteric use case.
Oh my God.
For a typical navigational task, yet
yeah.
For a human being, that's a pretty common way of thinking.
Yeah, and thank God in the real world, they don't move the post office around on you on a regular basis. But in UIs, they do. Like, wait, I used to know how to get there. They moved that.
Exactly. And I think having it's sort of having a conversation and say, well, you know, I found these 5 post offices. Looks like you went to this one. And then have it be smart enough to go, that's the one he's talking about, because he's given me enough information. I don't need to verify. And that's where Siri and Alexa are just, I think they're getting ready to die, because that constant sort of precision demanding humans to be precise.
Right.
When they least want to be precise.
Yeah.
Which is like, it's just completely antithetical to where this industry is going. And I love the fact that you can ask pretty open-ended questions, such as, you know, give me sales for last month. But at the same time, you can go to lanes like, explain to me what was the reason for sales decline? And did this go up and down? Or even sort of anticipate the next step, which again, as LLMs are really good at, to go, well, what's the next thing they're going to ask? Well, looks like it's lower than the previous month. That's a pretty natural next question. And here's why we think it's lower, and here's what you should be doing about it. Already kind of printing out for you, because you kind of, it's anticipating your next question. So it's smart enough to do that. Where again, sort of Siri and Alexa are completely losing that, because they're not in context. They don't have that ability to kind of stay within the conversation context and also pull in what's the next step. Whereas LLMs and ChatGPT kind of does that more or less naturally. I think a lot of folks are thinking in this terms, because you are getting a continuous, almost continuous experiential loop, that everything you're doing is going to print out the next step.
Right.
But you can almost go back and kind of trace that, but it's not quite there yet, but I think it will be. And it is very exciting, but also kind of scary at the same time. We realize we're temporal beings, right? We exist in time. We cannot go back. But this almost allows us to do that and kind of try a lot of things, even thought experiments, right? Like what would have happened had I invested in this stock versus that stock, and would I have been a billionaire? How would my life be different? You know, tell me a story about that.
Right.
Given everything you know about me and my personality, like you could totally do that. That's pretty incredible stuff.
There's something about these design challenges that we're sort of circling around right now that's actually reminding me of a trip that I took to Costa Rica pre Google Maps, pre-Apple Maps. The experience of driving in Costa Rica, and like particularly in San Jose, the capital, is that there are virtually no road signs anywhere. And if you ask a local for directions, they'll say like, well, you got to turn right where that statue of the Virgin Mary used to be. So it's like, I think it's the personalization aspect that's reminding me of that, because if we're trying to create experiences for people who have their own like kind of shadowy interior lives, the challenge is similar, right? Like we don't necessarily have the signposts or the names for things like the ontology problem you're mentioning, Rob. Like we have to figure out sort of this new vernacular. And then there's also like this challenge of, you know, every design process is different. Every designer's process is different, but so often they seem to kind of start with like you were saying, Greg, like wireframes or some sort of visual element. But now we're in this world where like the first step isn't like, what's it going to look like? It's like, what's it going to be like?
We need to move faster. We need to get more done. Now we have to say, what do users need? What is going to help them get their job done or make them happier? And we need to start using tools to measure the experience satisfaction of the end user, not the, were they able to get their job done quicker, but really, really gear into the journey mapping of emotion and like how much more pleasurable was this experience versus this other one? And not talk about rounding corners or flat design, or should that be bold or not bold?
I couldn't agree more. It is just, I mean, the stuff that people still kind of obsess about, it drives me absolutely insane. And even the tools that are getting released are still in that kind of infant. It's mapping our old concepts to what is a brand new world. The world has shifted, but we're still thinking in these old ways. Should I call out a tool or not? I guess I could. It's UIZERT or UZERT, right? Like that's a perfect example where it's almost like a tool for PMs or a tool for, it's not really a tool for designers, because it's just creating a bunch of like a visual palette of a bunch of screens that may or may not have the pieces you want for a particular job, but it's very much stuck in that kind of old paradigm. It's like, how do we speed up mediocre designs for mediocre designers?
Yeah.
And it's kind of infuriating, because it could be so much more, because you could potentially say, well, here's a design system, train on my design system, help me create these components that go directly to code, and then straight up create a code for a simple page like a table. Like, I never want to make another table again, for instance. Like, I've made way too many working in SaaS for 20 years, and I never want to make another one. And so, you know, AI is like a perfect thing for doing that, because you can say, look, you know, I need a table. These are the columns. I want it sorted by this. And you should have all the normal doodads. And then you can say, well, you know, what filters do you want on there? Well, you can probably guess what filters. And most of the tables start with an ID, and then they end with a date stamp. And then, you know, most of them are sorted by date. And that's a pretty straightforward thing, or they're sorted by status, for instance, and so forth. And then most tables nowadays, they have a way to mix the columns, so the customer can go rearrange the columns how they want. So spending human time creating these type of screens is an absolute waste of time. And then having spending human time coding these screens is also an absolute waste of time, right? We got to elevate our practice, elevate our discourse into what you said, which is like, what kind of questions are they liking to ask, and what are they expecting as an output for that question, should it even be a table? Should it be a graph? Should it, should we allow them to change that? Of course we should, right? Like, but what's the better scenario? And then how do we supplement that with other pieces of information so that they're kind of get a dashboard output rather than a single graph that supports their thought process and lets them make better decisions, almost like an Iron Man kind of suit of armor. Spending human time designing and coding tables and then spending months discussing that on Zoom meetings is insane at this point.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, our tools are still not there. And you know, not to pick on the user, but, again, what I would have expected or would have liked to see is make simple things simple. Allow me to do what humans do best, which is tell a story, you know, design a story, kind of end to end, how it fits together. But it doesn't really quite go far enough on that aspect, but it's going too far in the other way. So it's just kind of sampling a bunch of screens. Not to say, you shouldn't try it. You should definitely try it. You should see, decide for yourself, but we're kind of going in the wrong direction. We're using the old paradigm. We're kind of heading, like, here's kind of the simple stuff that I do. My job is really boring. Let me do my boring job even faster. Like that's not the right question.
Yeah, it's like being born with no arms, and then somebody finally gives you arms, but you still use your feet for everything.
Yes.
And
wow, that's pretty.
And you're like, oh,
painful.
Like,
yeah.
Why? Because it's the easiest way is the way I already know, and even if it was much harder to learn than the new way, it's still easier than the new way because I already know it. And we're in that moment where the software I know is the easiest because I already invested the time to learn it. And so when someone comes to me and says, oh, this is 10 times easier to use than to learn than the one you already know, they'll be like, no, it's not. Nothing could be faster to learn than the thing I already know. And so then they sort of discard it and say, I'll never let go of my spreadsheet because I already know it. But for every person who hasn't depended on a spreadsheet, they're going to go to the new system because it's easier to learn by a 10x factor. And I love that you brought up spreadsheets because I think it's a fantastic example of designing something where you don't know what the user is going to use it for. So you just make something so generic that you're like, I don't know what people are going to use this for, so I'm going to design something just really, really versatile, and then they can use it for whatever they want. I think there's like a common philosophy around the VC world with Angie's List, same idea, that it was sort of like a spreadsheet, right? You could put them both in the same category of these like universal tools that were designed by people who didn't know how users would use them. So they kind of put them out there to see how they use them. And then other companies spawned use cases and turned them into companies. Like Airbnb comes out of Angie's List, where people were offering rentals. And all these companies looked at use cases that were being done on Angie's List. And then they'd build bigger, more valuable companies out of the use cases. And the same went with spreadsheets. You see these companies that are like accounting software and things that people just looked at use cases, common use cases that people use spreadsheets for, and then built specific, tools around that use case. And so anybody who says, oh, I'd never let go of my spreadsheet, hasn't realized the value of those companies from just simply giving people an easier tool as a UI to a spreadsheet or to an Angie's List that's designed and catered to specific use cases. Now with conversation, that's not a 1 year or 2 year development process. We can now do that in a matter of a day or two. You could break these things out. So So whether someone will replace a spreadsheet or not is too big a conversation to have. Whether conversational AI will replace specific use cases of a spreadsheet or an Angie's List, that is an easy conversation to have. And we can just go use case by use case, and I can draw a journey map for each one on how it will do it. It's probably going to be different for each use case. And one might be that I'm going to put up a table of data because there's something about the high bandwidth value of visual data that allows me to scroll and scan. But the thing people don't realize is that micro UI is going to be embedded in the context of a conversation. So I'm going to say, hey, show me the last 100 sales from store number 3. And it's going to pop up a table and I can scroll it. What it's not going to do is take me to a spreadsheet program. And so I think a lot of people think that we're going to add AI to our spreadsheet programs, like generative AI, and that's going to solve our problem. And it's like, no, that's an interim step. That's still using our feet instead of our new hands that we just got. And it's really going to shift to, I don't need a spreadsheet program because I have these micro UIs, and it's just going to pop up and conjure up a table designed for that use case on the fly for me. And that's the new world is, I don't need to know where to go to get that data. I don't need to know where to go to find sales for the last 100. I just need to remember how to ask for it, which we all do really well.
I love that you mentioned that. That's kind of really dovetails into my favorite topic, which is the difference between design and documentation. What we do in Figma so often is documentation. And what we do kind of on the whiteboard or increasingly sticky notes and things that, you know, in interspatial kind of thinking and conversations, and maybe even working with our AI companions in a sort of augmented reality thing. But what we're doing there is designing.
Yeah.
And that's a different really good than point. Documentation. And so much of our industry is kind of it's historically really focused on documentation first.
Yeah. It sees it backwards too. They think it's design.
Yes.
Oh yeah, and
everyone
mistaken.
Else does too, right? Like PMs and devs are like, well, you know, I'm terrible at wireframing, and so you designers should do much better. Here's the
skin
design.
This thing,
we just want you to skin it. Exactly. Prettify it. Oh, my favorite word. Lordy, right? Like it's become so pervasive that I think with the advent of tools like Usered, right, you're gonna have basically PMs or devs just kind of going, well, I'm going to do my own design, and thinking that they went and documented it and they designed it.
Yeah.
Which is totally not the same thing. Totally not the same thing. Right. And I think just it's very urgent for us to kind of really elevate that discourse, but a lot of folks are missing that. And it's, they're still asking for, you know, give me a course on auto layout for Figma. Versus give me a course on how to think about these brand new paradigms that we've been given, these new hands that we've been given. And you know, you keep going like, tell me which toe to use for you know, XYZ. I love that analogy. It's pretty cruel, but it's apt, I think. And they're not realizing that the whole auto layout thing is gone. Like that's not even there. I mean, it's there in the interim because stuff is not evenly distributed, as I think William Gibson said, or one of those guys, one of those old sci-fi folks, if I'm mangling, my apologies, but future is here, but it's not evenly distributed. It's sort of here, but it's no longer viable. And we got to look to these much more interesting capabilities that many folks, I guess, have not exercised. And so I'm not exactly sure, but I think we're kind of, first off, I think what's going to happen is 80% or up to 80%, they're going to not have jobs, right? Like in the design, looking at the cards correctly.
I think it's interesting because, you know, in this world, we tend to copy each other's homework. And so
I love it.
Everyone's looking at everyone else's homework and they're all still drawing wireframes. And if everyone's copying each other, how's anything going to change, right? So you have, I could bring five UX folks in the room and they're all going to draw wireframes and they're all going to draw, look at the guy next to him. Oh, I'm going to draw wireframes like them. And they're going to, one of them's going to post it online so the others can copy their homework easily. Mm-hmm. And especially in UX, right? So until you start tipping it where more of the UXers are doing different things and seeing the world in different ways and are starting to solve company problems through conversational UIs, you know, they're all going to keep copying each other while just paying lip service to, oh, generative AI is cool. It's going to take our job. It's not going to, I believe wholeheartedly, and I've been pretty accurate. I wrote the book before the launch of ChatGPT because I knew that it would be stamped, that I had like sort of predicted this in a way that nobody could deny it. Cause a lot of people say they predicted it, but you know, it's easy to say after, and I think there's a lot of predictions in the book that have now come true. And the next one that I'm predicting is that we will replace all of our current UIs with conversational UIs over the next 3 to 5 years, every single one. And we will probably produce 3x as many UIs as we have over the last 30 years. So the idea that designers are going to be out of a job, not true. Wireframers will.
That's very well said. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Well, the whole process of designing experiences with conversational AI is interesting because, you know, I think the first step is sort of journey mapping, and that can be like a visual exercise and it can involve sketching and things. But then as you move into like prototyping and design and development, they all sort of coalesce because, especially with the tools that we've been using, like the prototype that you're making it has the bones of the actual design. Like it becomes the design and it has the development wrapped up in it too. So all those things are sort of happening at the same time, which I think is different than a lot of UX practitioners might be used to, where it's like kind of these separate processes and there might even be like gaps between where things fall through the cracks. And so it's like this much more whirlwind type experience.
Yeah. And we're going to have all of these like visual micro UIs that are embedded in conversations. When we talk, you know, we use things like PowerPoint images and, you know, there's a reason that motion picture became more popular than radio. Like we like to see images. We like, there's the ability to transmit data visually is much higher bandwidth than verbally. So this new language of linguistics and extra linguistics combined is going to be the new language of machines, not one or the other. And we'll still be, you know, to some degree, creating these micro UIs and we'll be designing these micro UIs. It's just that an AI is going to give us a launching pad where it's going to design a micro UI. It's going to be mostly done. And then a designer with good taste and a good eye will make improvements to it. And they'll just design 5 times as many UIs in a day than they used to. And the part that they'll do is only the part that matters, which is the delta between okay and good. And since we'll need 10 times as many UIs in the future, there'll be plenty of work for everyone.
I love that vision. I think you're absolutely right. I love how you said it, wireframers will not be needed, but designers will be more needed than ever. I couldn't agree more. I think
the more wireframers that don't design, the more designers will need.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. I think AI in general is just too important, as we've seen with the Boeing 737 falling out of the sky twice and the killing almost 400 people, and the anytime we apply sophisticated systems to real world, be it airplanes, financial services, you name it, right? Like even Facebook AI that controlled the news cycle around January 6th, that is another one of those examples where sort of runaway AI had a lot of unintended consequences. So designers are needed to look at that because AIs are just too important to be left just to data scientists and business people.
Yeah, I agree.
There is a lot of ethical and human considerations that you know, you need someone to actually put the work in to really understand the consequences. And we often don't know, right? So this ability to have targeted imagination, storytell, be able to converse with other people and come to an agreement and then rapidly prototype various outcomes. I mean, those are key critical skill set that some of us have and
others not so much.
That's the part that's going to be needed.
I really like what you said, because I feel like there's making that distinction between design decisions and designing. You know, design decisions will continue to be made by humans as a way to elevate design from what is going to be average, which is average will become what LLMs can produce automatically, and better design will be what an LLM and a human do together to elevate it beyond what average is, right? And that will require designers to make design decisions, less designing and sitting there and trying to create. I remember when it took a while to create, a gradient, right? And instead of like trying to create a gradient that looks natural, what they'll be doing is just making a decision. Should that be a gradient? Should that be stronger? Should that be less strong? Making those design decisions to improve upon, to elevate what an LLM does. That's the new world, and less the actual like mechanics of implementing a design like a drop shadow or a gradient. But what I think we're going to suffer from in the meantime is that same taxi drivers or tour guides is kind of what I put in this category. Taxi drivers, you know, had to memorize the city, and that was their advantage. And so we think of a map and the city as an interface. They know their way around, they've memorized it, and that gives them an advantage in their job. That gives them a way to get promoted and a way to be valuable in their company. So we often hear like, oh, that person knows Salesforce really well. Oh my God, go to them to ask questions. Or people mastering the geometry and the geographic nature of an interface. Like, how do you get this done? How do you get that done? Becomes a way to set themselves apart and to compete with other employees. And the same in design, your ability to master Figma or Photoshop. And these tools are a big part of how you value yourself and then how others value you in the job. It goes on your resume. And now it's going to be about the design decisions that you make and not so much about the tools you know. And that's, it's a funny thing because it used to be about the design decisions. Then it became more about the tools in some industries. In the film industry, when I was in there, editors and directors used to, you know, do everything on film. And so the mechanics were pretty simple. You cut the film, you splice the film. Knowing how to use a splicer was not very difficult, or a chem. And then all of a sudden came things like Avid, where now you had to know the software. And all of a sudden, all these young people from film school started breaking in to doing feature films because they knew the Avid, and the old school people didn't. But they didn't know how the art of filmmaking. And this was a huge challenge in the industry as people were coming in that didn't know the art of filmmaking, but knew how to use the tools. And I think we all of a sudden now are going back to it. We can take for granted the use of the tools, and we go back to, you know, those skill sets of making the right decisions, the right design decisions becoming the differentiator again. And of course, those who have valued themselves on the use of the tools, not their design decisions, are going to be threatened by this. And that's always a tough transition for folks to make. And I think a lot of people who don't have confidence in their ability to make design decisions well, to do better than an LLM, to say, oh, you know what, you're wrong. I think we should push this message or that message, or we should use, I think this design's too busy. We need to simplify, like, these kinds of design decisions. You're going to have to be better than an LLM at making them. An LLM is going to be as good as the internet as a whole. So the amalgamation of all designers together. So it's going to be very average. If you can make better than average design decisions, you'll thrive. And if you can't, and I think that'll be a tough transition. And I think it'll be tough for all of us to transition from the tools to the, to the strategy of design. But I find it exciting.
Yeah, likewise. And I love the way that I see it is it's going to be a lot more importance on qualitative user interviewing and interpretation and really connecting with the customer on that kind of very fundamental, empathetical level to try to understand what their deeper desires are and how to express that through the joining of the system and what they want to truly kind of design experiences, which is not something we've talked about. We kind of been doing for the last 10 years, I guess we've been doing a platform on which experience unfolds. Now we actually can design, or at least get closer to an experience, truly designing an experience that somebody has around a service or a company or a brand or something like that, right? Where and that is threatening. A lot of folks are not, as I'm finding, I was thinking that that's a job requirement to be able to interview customers and connect with them and joke and have a conversation and kind of get them to open up. But that is not, for a lot of folks, that is very, very difficult. They don't like doing that. They just want to know, and Figma auto layout, that's what I'm really good at. That's what I do all day. Like you said, that's what I know. Like, everybody comes to me because I'm the master of the Figma layout. Well, that's going to be really tough for that kind of segment of folks. But I think there are definitely still jobs there because we're going to need the AI whisperers to kind of take a design system and train the AI on your design system so that it can produce these kind of run-of-the-mill simple wireframes, simple components, and go all the way to code. And that actually brings me to my next prediction, which is kind of like, what will be sort of the ultimate result of this is I think AI is going to on the fly write the code, almost like the interpreter type of code that is going to change the interface for every customer that they interact with. And that will be, I think, pretty incredible because it will be designing interface in real time. We'll just give it kind of a set of general parameters and what we're trying to get
done. Yeah, it's like a style guide. We're still going to have that style guide because we're going to want continuity across experiences.
And we're going to create context. Brand alignment and so forth, right?
Yeah, it just means like every designer becomes a creative director. That's really what it comes down to, right?
Yes. And I think another point that I want to make is we were always kind of threatened by, or I wouldn't say threatened, but it's more like there's always these other industries that were encroaching on the design. So everyone's a designer. Everyone heard of that, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's true because your PMs have a lot of opinions and your devs have a lot of opinions on how should this work and how should this look? What should be the, even down to the rounded buttons and what the color should be, et cetera, right? So everybody's a designer, but designers are, we sort of shied away from development and that they were called, unicorns and, they're asking the job description that you have you know, for a junior designer, you needed 5 years in development and 5 years in wireframing and 6 years in customer research and so forth.
I think there's a big assumption in all of this that, you know, this is my bias, but there's a big assumption in all of this that we're doing a good job designing our software today.
Oh, man. Yes. That's terrible. We're terrible.
And I
most
think
most experiences suck.
Yeah. If you want to look at the amount of software that's made versus the amount of software that gets used, and the amount of software that's designed versus the amount of software that gets used, it's an incredible waste, so little of our software actually gets used. And I always just look at number of apps in the app store versus number of apps on your phone versus number of apps you actually use that you put on your phone. It's so minimal. And the amount of time we've all spent, collective humanity, trying to design software that people use. And it's probably worse, like it's far worse odds than VCs have with like companies' success, right? You know, it's like we might, I don't know what it's, 1,000 features and then one maybe gets regular use that's been designed, 1,000 apps and maybe one becomes popular. And I think that's even optimistic. So if you look at it through a pessimistic lens and you say most of the software we build is not being used, then we have a problem we must solve. Therefore, the things we're doing can't be right. It can't be a right way to do it. It's got to be the wrong way to do it. And this is an opportunity to change it, whether you agree or not, and you think it's going to improve it or not is another story. Because we have to try something on the basis that so far it's such a failure. that we have to try something else and see if at least we can improve. Because in my opinion, there's only one way to go from here is up. I don't know how we could get worse in terms of the amount of software we build and the amount of software that we actually use on a daily basis.
On top of it, I think it's accelerating because these end-to-end simple, that's kind of what I'm seeing as kind of the theme for 2023. I think a lot of folks are just so fed up with COVID too, that I think it accelerated that trend that was there, but we want simple, frictionless, end-to-end stuff. And as soon as there is a little bit of anything, like,
oh my God.
Yeah. And I think that's gotten more and more, the expectation that it will be that frictionless and that easy, and most things are just not. And I describe recently I put an article out there where I was describing a simple use case as a song playing on the radio. I'm trying to figure out what that song is. I'm trying to add it to my Amazon music playlist.
Right.
Oh my gosh. Right. So I could not make it work no matter what I did, so I had to pull over and actually type things in, and you would think like that's such a common use case and it should be almost frictionless, but it isn't, because there are these app silos and the way our virtual assistants just aren't understanding simple commands, and they're just not that capable, and they still suck, and I think that was the problem that sort of Apple suddenly on its laurels and Amazon and Google and so forth. So I'm really glad that OpenAI kind of kicked their butt a little bit and it kicked it into this new gear, because it was very much stagnated where they could have done so much more, where they would take the context in, et cetera, but it just was like, oh, this is good enough. We don't need to work on it. So competition is great, but it's definitely, people are seeing this and they're expecting these things to be easier and faster. And I think they will always, I'm going to make that prediction now, they will always gravitate toward things that are easier, even though they're not as powerful. And I don't think they ever did the more powerful thing. Like, we kind of assume that some of them did, at least a thin slice of the population. But now that thin slice has become, I mean, almost negligible. So 98% of the tasks are going to pick easy. And I think that is something we cannot stop. And the faster we kind of embrace it, the better. And that is changing everything about our industry. It's changing the way PMs are thinking and the way that the devs are thinking and the way that the UXers are thinking, and or at least it should.
Right.
It's not there yet. We're playing catch up right now. And I think that the people are already there, the public, but we're still not. And I think that 2024 is going to be the catch up year of us like suddenly seeing, oh yeah, like easy will be better, because then they can just follow up with another easy question, the same query. Like, you don't need a query that does everything. You don't need a priori to say, well, show me all the sales, to use your example, Rob, show me all the problems with my sales for 2024 for US.
Yeah.
Because you can start by having the conversation and then narrow down almost like normally humans do, because it's very hard to formulate that type of query from the beginning. But maybe that's your goal, but you start out by saying, okay, show me the sales. All right, show me sales for US. Okay, what's wrong with the sales versus the previous version? And then sort of slowly narrow down, because what we find changes what we seek, as Peter Morville said. I love that. I love that sentiment. And I think it's more and more, we're doing this on the side of that. We're somewhat distracted. We're maybe using 20% of our attention for this task, because we're watching a cat video and our boss is calling and our significant other is over here and the kids are running around and all that stuff. And you're still stuck in the house while you're seeing a beautiful sun outside. Yep. And then, you know, having that be an easier flow, that's going to be really the goal for a lot of that. And we're not there yet, but I think we better be in, you know, soon.
I hate to wind this conversation
down. I would just
really
go
on the verge
on.
Of solving the UX and AI problem.
Yes.
But
so
I think we could definitely pick it up another time.
We should.
Yeah,
great.
I would love that.
Greg, this has been fantastic. We definitely appreciate you joining us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. It's a pleasure.
You gave me a soapbox to just like things that have been on my mind that I've wanted to say, you know.
I love it. And we got this.
I haven't seen Rob this excited in a while.
Yeah.
So
all right. Well, thanks again for joining this ongoing conversation about conversational AI. Be sure to subscribe to Invisible Machines wherever you get your podcasts. And if you feel so inclined, please leave us a review on the Apple Podcast app. You can also watch these conversations on the Invisible Machines YouTube channel. This podcast is produced for UX Magazine in partnership with OneReach.ai. Over the past 5 years, our team of nearly 200 engineers, scientists, experienced designers, anthropologists, and linguists have been developing Generative Studio X, an award-winning platform that has the lone distinction of being named a leader by every major analyst group. GSX is a complete environment for hosting, creating, analyzing, and scaling your own digital teammates called Intelligent Digital Workers. For an interactive demo of IDWs in action and to learn more about the GSX platform, head to onereach.ai. This podcast would not be possible without the hard work and dedication of executive producer Elias Parker and producer Kate Timchenko. Our video and audio editor is Michael Litvinov, and we rely on support from the marketing team at onereach.ai, including Allison Harshberger, Anastasia Nechtalio, and Vera Prokodko. Thanks again, and we look forward to connecting with you next week, right here on Invisible Machines.